Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Seven Virginians, The Men Who Shaped Our Republic, by John B. Bowles, narrated by Brandon Pollack. Introduction. It is one of the single most remarkable facts of American history. Within the span of slightly more than three decades, 1725 through 1758, seven men were born in the northeast quadrant of the colony of Virginia who would ultimately play a vastly disproportionate role in the founding of this nation. In order of birth, they were George Mason, George Washington, Patrick Henry, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, John Marshall, and James Monroe. All household names, it is true, but their closely intertwined lives and careers have never before been integrated and jointly employed to tell the story of how the colonies came to break away from their mother country, fight a revolution, and write a constitution, thereby establishing a new nation. They helped ratify that constitution, set the infant nation in motion, develop its governing procedures, organize its first political parties, evolve the role of the president, and subsequently guide the maturation of the Supreme Court. In each of these critical events, one or more of this group of men played essential roles. That is, they were indispensable actors in the creation of the United States. Of course, there were other influential leaders from other colonies, particularly Massachusetts and Pennsylvania, but no other colony produced such a large cluster of such significant leaders as did Virginia. I became fascinated several years ago by the extraordinarily important role these seven had in shaping the development of the political institutions and practices of the nation, and the fact that they all came from a small region of one colony. That prosperous region had a stable economy based on the cultivation of tobacco by enslaved African American laborers. Out of this milieu, these seven men came of age having been provided with a basic education and a set of beliefs about local governance. From an inheritance of family name, land, and enslaved men, women, and children, they all had or soon gained the leisure and opportunity to expand that initial education and develop leadership skills. They were ambitious and were given or seized opportunities to extend their roles in local government. Their property holdings also tended to grow over time, and in various ways they quickly emerged as societal leaders. Almost automatically, they, like other similarly placed individuals, accepted slaveholding as a rightful part of their natural order and presumed the wholesomeness of an agricultural and/or plantation way of life. Had they been born elsewhere, say Massachusetts, they likely would have thought differently, but they were from Virginia. While all eventually began to question, to varying degrees, the morality and financial viability of slavery, they were in the end incapable of completely divorcing themselves from the world into which they had been born. These men wove an accommodation to slavery, usually blatant but often subtle, into all aspects of society, with everything from political institutions to social etiquette bearing its influence. The presence of many who were unfree in their society may very well have led Virginia's leaders even more to value their own liberties as white men and even sense a degree of commonality among men of their race. Notably, the first rumblings of dissent against England occurred in the context of white Virginians' hypersensitivity to preserving their own precious liberties. Democracy for whites and slavery for non-whites was, to our everlasting regret, part of our founding. I recognize that a book about seven white slaveholders will appear inappropriate or even repugnant to some audiences in 2023, but I believe it is important to see these men in all of their complexities, good and bad, if we are to face our history honestly and with completeness. Having often taught non-credit general education classes for decades, and in Maryland, Louisiana, and Texas, I know many otherwise well-educated Americans are unfamiliar with the background of the founders and the political and economic issues they confronted. At a time when many of the basic principles of our nation are forgotten, unknown, or even rejected, I think it important to give a relatively full historical context for listeners, more so than perhaps would have been necessary a generation or two before. I hope to offer in part, at least, a civics refresher. One might ask, at what point should such a book begin? Nation-building clearly did not commence in 1787 with the drafting of the Constitution, or even 1776 with the Declaration of Independence. Rather, the process of creating a new nation began when colonists in mainland North America first started to see their fundamental interests as different from those of the mother country. We cannot fully understand the motives and actions of those we call the founders unless we see them in this longer chronological context. As John Adams wrote in 1818, "The revolution was effected before the war commenced. The revolution was in the minds and hearts of the people." For that reason, our story starts in the 1740s. What might be generously called the Long Revolutionary Era ended in Virginia about 1830, when that state essentially repudiated the progressive nationalism of the founders and began its headlong march toward an increasingly conservative state rightism that eventually and tragically led to secession and civil war. Hence the chronological boundaries of our story. I remember a comment a taxi driver in London had made to my son David in 2009, shortly after the first election of Barack Obama to the U.S. presidency. "That could never happen in this country," he had said with a sense of awe. But were we truly that unique? Whether or not that comment was correct, and I doubted it, it led me to ponder the origins of this nation, its fundamental institutions, its gradual, sometimes grudging, openness over time to new people and new ideas. Could the story of these seven white men help provide some understanding of this evolution? What exactly had motivated these similar, but again quite different leaders? Certainly, they all appreciated the exciting opportunity they had to break away from the control of the mother country, and most of them seized the chance to participate in the actual creation of a new nation, one larger than a single state. How had they responded to change, to crisis, to remarkable economic and geographical expansion? Did their viewpoints evolve over time? I hope that by examining aspects of the careers of seven political leaders during a critical era of our nation's history, I could develop a clearer knowledge of our past. And I wanted to relate that history in a way that was accessible to general listeners throughout the nation, for this was much more than simply a Virginia story. It is an essential part of the American story. Perhaps it goes without saying that if there were leaders, there had to be followers. Key to leadership is the ability to motivate, educate, inspire, and direct a significant fraction of the general population. These seven men had that ability in spades. Their skills were varied. Washington possessed an austere charisma that generated immense respect and support. Henry's remarkable oratory moved people to act. Jefferson's literary power and idealism persuaded people to trust in democracy. These three have famously been labeled the sword, the trumpet, and the pen of the Revolution. Mason's thoughtful writing gave him great influence, and everyone appreciated the penetrating intelligence of Madison's words. Marshall's plain-written logical analysis of issues built adherence to the Constitution and undergirded the growing support for the national government. Monroe was probably the least skilled of the seven, but his earnest, if awkward, phraseology nevertheless garnered support for his positions. Out of a mix of leadership styles, especially the power of spoken and written word, was the nation built, and that such a democratic system of government was established in an era of powerful monarchs and nearly universal autocracy was no minor miracle. It did not begin with democracy for all people, although over time and through difficult struggles, democratic practices eventually expanded. Admittedly, our democratic prospects as a nation have been threatened over the last years. There was a huge gap between the men I focus on and most of our recent leaders, and the controversies and disputes of the last years have raised profound questions in the minds of many about the durability of our founding institutions. Looking at the dysfunctionality of our recent Congresses, the apparent lack of character, courage, and outstanding political ability in a nation of over 300 million people, the repeated repudiation of the principle of compromise, the widespread rejection of science and distrust of experts, the persistence, even intensification, of racism and xenophobia, the shocking January 6, 2021 assault on the Capitol building and the working of Congress, and the continuing unwillingness of millions of people to accept fair election results, how was it possible that a collection of colonies totaling only about 3 million people ever established a nation that is now the world's longest-lasting, if imperfect, democracy? These seven Virginians furnished a manageable sample size to investigate aspects of that story, and their ample correspondence offers insights into their beliefs and behavior. They certainly were not men without faults, even grievous ones. They had glaring blind spots about such things as race and gender. They often disagreed with one another, and their influence was clearly uneven. Still, the political ideas, institutions, and practices these imperfect men helped create contain possibilities they did not fully comprehend and that we have not always lived up to. I invite you to join me as we seek to know these men of more than two centuries ago and explore how they helped create a nation. The result was far from perfect, but it allowed, often in response to protest, civil conflict, even war, for changes to be made over time that inched the nation toward that ideal expressed in the opening line of the Constitution, achieving a more perfect union. Context is always critical to comprehending the past. If we are to make sense of the careers of our seven actors, we must situate them in their place and time in history. They were propertied, free white men who came of age in 18th century Virginia. We should not forget that they most decidedly did not have the attitudes of modern Americans. How could they? In the years following 1725, the colony seemed to be approaching a golden age, at least for the white elite. But Virginia also had a larger population of enslaved persons by far than any other colony, and for them, this was by no means a golden age. And the great majority of Virginia's white population were non-slaveholding small farmers and indentured servants. However, the gentry, 3% or less of the total population, set the tone for the society and controlled politics. Although tobacco prices fell for several years after 1720, on the whole, these were prosperous times for mainland America's oldest, most populous, and most profitable colony. For a significant fraction of the non-elite whites, there was even upward mobility. Death rates had stabilized a generation before, Indian wars had become a thing of the past, and the slave agricultural economy was booming. Between 1700 and 1750, approximately 45,000 enslaved Africans were imported into the colony, and because of indigenous population growth, the total number of blacks in 1750 reached 100,000, or almost 44% of the colony's total population. The fundamental character of the colony was evolving. Whites increasingly accepted the presence of enslaved people as normative, and by mid-century, Virginia contained more such people by far than any other mainland British colony. Few whites questioned slavery's morality, and fewer still questioned its role in the economy. Tobacco production was such, especially since by then the British had tapped the immense European market for snuff, that Virginia's trade with the mother country amounted to fully one-third of Britain's commerce with her mainland colonies. The colony largely governed itself with almost no interference or oversight by Parliament or the Crown, and expected that virtual autonomy to continue. Wealthy, stable planters paid to have large, stately homes designed and constructed, usually by enslaved workers, for themselves. Think Nominee Hall, Stratford Hall, and Westover and Middleton plantations, along the lower stretch of the James and other wide, slow-moving tidal rivers, and similar homes were built in succeeding decades. Although some elite whites occasionally expressed worries, usually privately, about the morality of slavery, almost no one turned down the profits that slave-cultivated tobacco could bring. In 1730 or so, few could see on the horizon significant problems for their society. Yet, perceptions could be deceptive. The geographical setting for our beginning is, again, but a small portion of colonial Virginia as it evolved from complacency to rebellion. During this era, Virginia was a growing participant in an accumulation of protests that slowly transformed random conflicts between England and the various colonies into what would become the genesis of a self-conscious, nationalizing movement. Among many political actors in Virginia, our seven men stood out for their leadership. They all knew one another, shared central viewpoints at one time or another, and contributed to the national narrative, though in time they came to disagree and oppose each other, and in doing so, they represented practically the full spectrum of outlooks that defined American politics during the age. Their intertwined biographies help us to understand an eventful era in American history. Although Virginia's agriculture would over time diversify, and the state eventually became a major wheat-growing and milling center, at the beginning of our story, tobacco cultivation completely dominated the colony's economy. By the middle of the previous century, tobacco planters realized that the crop quickly depleted the nutrients of the soil, so the only way to guarantee long-term prosperity was to acquire large acreages. Depleted land could be abandoned and cultivation shifted to fresh soil. Consequently, the more affluent planters soon owned most of the arable lands near waterways, essential in an age when bulk goods were most efficiently shipped by boat. Earlier, many small farmers had cultivated tiny patches of tobacco, but by the late 17th century, wealthier men, utilizing larger workforces of enslaved black laborers, had already begun to dominate the colonial economy. This agricultural reality would shape the pattern of settlement for the next century and a half, and it established the procurement of additional acreage as a central concern for planters and ambitious farmers. Purchase of land and speculation in massive landholdings ever further to the west, in fact, came to be a defining characteristic of the wealthiest and politically dominant men of the colony, a trait the royal governors and other government officials came to share. Well-placed speculators by the late 1740s were obtaining blocks of land of up to 100,000 acres, and in 1749 alone, the government approved land grants of more than 1 million acres. In 1747, the so-called Ohio Company obtained 200,000 acres along the Ohio River, with the prospect of more than doubling that acreage if it successfully established a fort and settled 100 families in the region within 7 years. Investors in the project would soon include such men as George Washington and George Mason, who spent an enormous amount of time contemplating land acquisition. But Virginians proved not to be the only men who cast greedy eyes upon these munificent tracts of virgin land. The French and Canada were eager to occupy the region of the Ohio Valley too, and they could envision linking up with French settlements along the Gulf Coast. In 1749, they sent an expedition under the command of Pierre-Joseph Céloron de Blainville south of Lake Erie and across western Pennsylvania, burying lead plates to mark their perpetrated boundaries of French territory and establishing several small forts, meanwhile gaining the support of local American Indians who correctly saw the English settlers as permanent occupiers, not transient hunters. These French advances upset not only Virginians, and especially the powerful land speculators with investments in the Ohio Company, but authorities in England as well. Virginia Lieutenant Governor Robert Dinwiddie, the de facto royal governor, a fellow investor in the company, instantly saw the threat to Virginia interests, and in 1753 requested approval from his superiors to erect forts in the disputed territory. From King George II came permission to send a diplomatic mission to the French occupiers to warn them that they were trespassing upon British territory and, if they did not agree to leave, "We do hereby strictly charge and command you to drive them off by force of arms." Dinwiddie did not have ready at hand a militia force or military command structure, so he turned to an inexperienced young Virginian, 21-year-old George Washington, to lead an 8-man expedition into the contested region to demand the French forces to withdraw. With this mission, our story begins. 1. The First Rumblings. What about youthful George Washington recommended him to the royal governor of Virginia as the right person to address what Britain saw as a French incursion into Virginia territory in 1753? Born northeast of Richmond in Westmoreland County, near the Potomac River, on February 22, 1732, Washington was not initially privy to great wealth, although his father came to own substantial acreage and, by his death, about 50 enslaved men, women, and children. But his father died when George was only 11, and he was primarily raised by his mother in a farmhouse near Fredericksburg. Young George looked up to his two older half-brothers, but his hypercritical, even hateful mother had a larger psychological influence. Washington coped by learning to control his every emotion and would always be extremely sensitive to criticism and eager to win approval. Early on, he copied out a set of more than 100 rules for civility and good behavior, originally composed by a Jesuit scholar in the late 17th century, and he sought diligently to shape his life accordingly. Washington grew to be extraordinarily ambitious both for fame and money, and he learned to obsequiously court the support of powerful men about him. Never scholarly like the famously so Thomas Jefferson or James Madison after him, or even George Mason, Washington learned surveying, studying books on military demeanor and strategy, and polished his social skills. At 6 feet tall, muscular, with an erect bearing and elegant on horseback, Washington cut an impressive figure. Even at an early age, the worth of his character shone, and hints of his later charisma were already present. He simply sold himself and his promising leadership ability to Governor Dinwiddie. Washington signed up an experienced frontiersman, Christopher Gist, to join his squad, and the small body of men traversed rugged terrain, endured almost impossibly cold weather, escaped an Indian assassination attempt, formed a temporary alliance with Seneca Chief Tenakarasin, and finally reached the outpost of the French just south of Lake Erie. A naive Washington gave the French commander there the message that he should vacate the region and turn it over to the British, only to be completely rebuffed by the French officer. Washington and his small contingent returned to Williamsburg, where on January 16, 1754, he handed Governor Dinwiddie a rough journal account of his efforts and a letter from the French officer dismissing the English demand. Washington's journal revealed the fruits of his reconnoitering of the territory, which included identifying the location of French positions and estimates of their troop strength. Dinwiddie asked Washington to write up and polish his report as a message to the council, and the hastily drafted report was also published in the Williamsburg and other newspapers. This report or journal gained Washington instant local fame, and although it revealed the failure of his mission, readers saw him as hardy, brave, and forthright in his stance against the French. The failed mission, ironically, made Washington a Virginia hero. Governor Dinwiddie soon found additional funds and gathered a small force of Virginia men to return to the Ohio Territory. On April 2, 1754, Washington, now heading a regiment of 300, left Virginia to return to the disputed territory, but he quickly learned that a much larger French force had entered the region. On July 3, French forces attacked, subjecting Washington's men to withering gunfire. The Virginians, completely outgunned, took horrendous casualties. For some reason, the French commander, Louis Colon de Villiers, showed mercy. In the midst of a rainstorm, Washington surrendered. De Villiers was surprisingly generous. Although the Virginia troops were required to surrender the fort, they were allowed to keep their weapons. They agreed to leave the Ohio country for a year, and they were given a pass to return to Virginia. Washington led the defeated troops home, where once again he was feted as a hero for resisting the French. Washington grossly exaggerated the number of casualties his men inflicted on the French forces, despite his thorough defeat. Virginia's House of Burgesses commended Washington, but also deactivated the Virginia regiment that he had commanded and redistributed the forces across 10 companies, each with their own leader. Ever sensitive, Washington felt slighted by the move and resigned. As if to sartorially compensate for what was in effect a demotion, he ordered from England materials to have tailored for himself a resplendent military uniform. Washington had been fighting to protect the interests of the colony of Virginia and its ambitious planters. However, in London, wiser heads with a larger perspective on international strategy understood that the issues at stake were greater than skirmishes over a fort or two claimed by Virginians. Would France or England eventually control the region and the continent? This was to be a war for a North American empire. In February 1755, British officials sent General Edward Braddock with two regiments of the British Army to Virginia. Braddock was an accomplished officer, but the only warfare he knew were conflicts on the open plains of Europe, where disciplined formations of men lined up and fired at one another. Confident of British military superiority and contemptuous of both Virginia soldiers and Native American fighters, Braddock assumed he would march smartly across Virginia and enter the backcountry to certain victory. Washington hoped to get a commission in the British Army, but all Braddock would offer was that Washington could become a member of his staff. A disappointed Washington in protest agreed to serve without pay. He had learned enough about warfare in the rugged terrain of the West and the unorthodox by European standards of Native American warfare that he found the gradual British march westward infuriating. Sure enough, Braddock's progress slowed to a crawl when, on July 9th, Indians and French soldiers attacked, suddenly appearing from the woods or from behind rocks to fire on the redcoats, only to disappear into the wilderness. The British took frightening losses. Braddock himself was killed, and Washington, displaying great courage and stamina, helped bring order to the rattled British forces and organized a successful retreat. The remaining British regulars went into so-called winter quarters in safe Philadelphia in the middle of the summer. Washington never received the military commission he desired, but he nevertheless had grown confident in his ability to command and had come to see that the British Army was not invincible in the kind of warfare practiced on the American scene. He never forgot that lesson. The House of Burgesses in August authorized funds to reorganize the Virginia Regiment and it named Washington in command. For the next several years, he recruited men, trained them, instilled a sense of discipline in his troops, and with a still surprisingly small force, attempted to bring order and a cessation of Indian warfare along the extensive western frontier. Washington was a severe disciplinarian, punishing his soldiers for infractions like drunkenness with up to 1,000 lashes, and he had deserters hanged. But he succeeded in molding his men into an effective fighting force, much better than the voluntary and only slightly trained militia that he had held in contempt. By now he considered himself a far superior commander than the British officers he had met. Yet in these years, the major theater of the war between the French and English had moved to the Great Lakes region and along the St. Lawrence River, where the iconic battle would ultimately turn out to be General James Wolfe's stunning victory over the Marquis de Montcalm on the Plains of Abraham near Quebec in September 1759. Before that British triumph, officials in England had in April 1758 sent General John Forbes to retake Fort Duquesne. Forbes, with twice the number of troops that Braddock had commanded, was competent, generally willing to take advice from Washington and others experienced in Western warfare, and welcomed his aid. Forbes moved expeditiously into the Ohio Territory and, with the military assistance of Washington and his Virginia regiment, regained Fort Duquesne. Although Washington was still young, headstrong, and perhaps too sure of his own abilities, over the past 5 years he had honed his martial skills to the point that he was, at the age of 26, indisputably Virginia's military leader. By hard work, an iron will, study, and self-discipline, he had fashioned himself into a persona that elicited respect from his soldiers and earned the admiration of most of his fellow men. Meanwhile, the war was coming to an end, with the French thoroughly defeated. Conflicts intensified in the final years between English colonists and Native Americans along the western and southern frontier, but hostilities with the French ceased. A comprehensive peace treaty was signed in Paris in 1763, freeing the British colonies from any threat from another European power. Most colonies were pleased with the removal of the French and proud at the moment to be British, but beneath the apparently calm surface, other issues had already begun to emerge between the mainland colonies and British authorities. No one foresaw the complications that came to a head over the next few years, complications that had taken root a generation earlier. For the first 4 decades of the 18th century, English authorities had largely left Virginians to manage their own affairs, including passing laws and regulating land purchases. Virginia prospered and grew. In fact, its population doubled between 1730 and 1760. This had produced the demand for land that underwrote the worries about French ambitions in the region. In the years following 1740, the Board of Trade in London began to take more interest in colonial affairs. What caught its attention was a complete overhaul by the Virginia Assembly in 1748 and 1749 of its whole set of laws, which had arisen willy-nilly over the years and had become outdated, repetitive, and sometimes insufficiently precise. The Assembly had expected no complications from the Board of Trade, but the Earl of Halifax, now the head of the Board of Trade, had just begun a process of tightening administrative procedures and overseeing more carefully England's far-flung colonies. Virginia's revision of its laws became caught up in the enhanced supervisory procedures of the Board of Trade, with the result that the board in 1751 rejected 10 Virginia laws, placed 7 on probationary status, sent 3 to the Treasury for examination, and approved 57. This action stunned the Virginia legislature. Never before had the colony been subjected to such interference. Governor Dinwiddie soon created another provocation, in part because he wanted to more closely regulate land sales and thereby collect rents due the crown. He decided to charge a fee on all land patents, claims. The members of the General Assembly saw this as an unprecedented attempt to gouge money from the citizens, in effect, to tax them without their consent. Protests went all the way to the Privy Council in London. Ultimately, the Privy Council so limited the applicability of the fee as to render it of little effect, but the council took care not to legally limit the power of a governor to levy such fees. The controversy raised colonial concerns about taxing authority and initiated conversations about local control of taxation. Another unforeseen irritant between the colony of Virginia and the mother country arose in the late 1750s after several years of crop failures tripled the price of tobacco. The state religion of colonial Virginia was Anglicanism, and for years, Law had set the salaries of Anglican ministers at six.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?